Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey. Following a 30-minute Shamatha Vipassana meditation session, our Sangha discussion is on the five hindrances, and my talk introduces this week's study of the Ratana Sutta. Included in my talk is a reference to the Kalama Sutta, and how ignorance of the Buddhist teachings and a misunderstanding of true refuge often leads to continued suffering. Two of the references are to modern Buddhist lineages, both intentionally developing a Buddhist practice that is a clinging together of many different and often contradictory teachings that only obscures and continues ignorance of the Buddha's direct teachings and leads to often abusive behaviors within sanghas. This video was recorded on March 4, 2017. This class is part of a series from our 2016-2017 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study, based on my book, The Truth of Happiness. If you find benefit from this recording, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So I'd like to hear how your study went on the hindrances, and if you see and understand how the hindrances relate to the Dhamma practice and to the Four Noble Truths, and developing understanding of suffering and our individual contributions through craving and clinging.
Wow.
Intimidating.
Or anything else you want to say. Well, here's a better way of saying it. What'd you get out of it? Becky, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you too. I learned from that really most of the hindrances are not that big of a problem for me, except the one that says you don't make the time. I don't have anybody around me who's not encouraging me. And then secondly, when I sit down, when I say, okay, I'm going to go meditate, when I sit down, then, and I'm in my house, I just keep thinking of things that I don't want to forget to do while I'm trying to meditate. And in one instance, I almost got up and did the thing that I didn't want to forget to do. And I managed to just come back to my breathing, realize that this was going to take care of itself, and I went on and did my meditation. And when I do that, it's very helpful in my life. I mean, it's really, I really like the way I feel when I make a commitment to do that. And it also teaches me that I can let go of all of those little rituals, that I don't have to keep running those things through my mind, that they will take care of themselves. But it's only for that instant that I realize it, and then I just go right back to doing the same thing. You know, I mean, I just, it's very hard for me to carry it on into my daily routine. Even, write speech and write, trying not to react and trying to respond rather than react. I'm still looking for a time when I do that. I mean, I don't think of doing it. It's not automatic by any means. And I did do it one time this past week, and I did just noble silence, and it made a situation that could have been, testy, calm, and actually turned it into kind of a joke, So it just passed away. Yeah. But when I do meditate, I usually meditate for about 15 minutes, and the time just, I open my eyes and I think, oh, I was probably only meditating like 2 minutes. And I looked at my watch, it was 15 minutes. So I'm going to work very hard, trying to have right intention and at least do that every morning. I find when I first get up is the easiest time for me to do it.
Most people find that. Excuse me.
So I guess I did mention a lot of hindrances, didn't I?
I would say you covered at least three of them. And all that's very common, Becky. And what you described, developing the foundation for Dhamma practice is just that way. You're mm-hmm. developing the first thing that you need to develop, and it's rooted in concentration that's developed in meditation, is recognition of the problem, recognition of where you're not within the framework of the Eightfold Path. And from that understanding, then you can develop the release from clinging, the renunciation part of it. But, you know, that that's exactly how it is. So good for you. In that working hard, though, that you mentioned at the end, remember to be very gentle while you're working hard, because
right.
that's so important. The hindrances are sensory, the need for sensory input or sensory distraction, ill will, laziness, torpor or disinterest, and drowsiness.
Doubt.
Pardon me?
Doubt.
Yeah, doubt and skepticism. And right in between there is restlessness and worry. And, you know, you kind of described almost all of that, especially that they all kind of flow from the first hindrance, the need for sensory input or sensory distraction.
Right.
That leads to restlessness. It leads to a feeling of boredom, and I just can't do this, and I have too many things going on in my life, and I need to be here, and I need to be there. When we meditate, it's good to remind ourselves, this is what I'm doing now. I'm not doing anything else. Now is the time to meditate. And whether it's for 2 minutes or 30 minutes, that's what you do. And when things come up that seem to be pulling at you, now's the time to meditate. You can also remind yourself that this is not me, this is not mine, at least right now.
Right.
You know, right now all I'm doing is being mindful of my breath and come back to it. But yeah, thank you.
Thank
you're integrating it exactly how it should be in a pretty short time, too. So. Jen, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. I like what you said about just now about kind of this is what I'm doing right now.
Yes.
Because I feel like that kind of is applicable to like any time that you're doing something and other things start to come up that you think you need to do. And you say, oh, no, right now is time to do this.
Yeah.
Even like when you're trying to go to sleep, you know. A million things come to my mind, and you know, you say, okay, now it's the time to sleep those things. I'm not going to deal with those things right now. You know, so you can see how practicing that in meditation can sort of help you apply it throughout your day.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed the part, like, my second pass at this chapter, I definitely always thought of the hindrances before as being just kind of a hindrance to meditation. Mm-hmm. And now it was like almost the first sentence of the chapter. It was like talking about how when you have a hindrance or you're like experiencing a hindrance, you don't even know what the skillful action is. You can't know what is good for you, and you can't know what is good for others if you have this hindrance.
Yep.
That was like, that solidified some stuff for me, because I, you know, moving through my day, if I'm feeling, you know, for me it's ill will. A lot of ill will.
So like a lot of hate inside me or something.
Just getting frustrated with people and events being different than what I want it to be is just it's like often what I'm coming up against. And, you know, when I experience that, the agitation, I know that, you know, I'm in ego. I know that because I'm agitated, I'm in ego, but you know, it's like, what do I do And so, you know, I wound up just being like, you need to put it away. You need to just meditate. You need to, like, get back into the moment. But reading that chapter kind of helped me see that is the right thing to do. Because I was still doubtful that it was really doing the right thing. Because when you're agitated and confused, you're confused, and you have this obstruction to skillfulness. And you know, all you want to do is just get rid of the obstruction. But if that's what you're trying to do, then you're not gonna see it. You're not gonna see the skillful action. You have to let the obstruction fall away, and before you can really get the insight to know what is skillful, and maybe there's nothing to do even. And you explain that beautifully when you're talking about the ill will piece, because you say, basically you imply that it really takes time, especially with something like ill will or doubt. Like, it takes a long time of practice before you can even really start to understand why you're feeling ill will.
Yeah, it does.
So if that becomes the goal, then you're going to be lost.
You're going to be lost. Because once you start doing that, then you're off the path.
Right.
You've lost the framework of the Eightfold Path, which is the way of seeing things clearly or developing right view. So what you just described, recognize that you're caught up in something. If it's caught up in ill will, just recognize it. You can't analyze it. You can't figure it out. Because when you're in that state of mind and you're trying to figure out ill will, it's always going to be blaming the situation or blaming another person.
Right.
Or it might be blaming yourself. Why am I such a mess?
Right.
You know?
Right. Sounds so modern.
Yeah, and that's all part of... I mean, there might be some...
Sure.
There might be some reality.
Right.
A temporary reality in that. But the bigger picture is that all of it is rooted in ignorance, giving rise to assumptions or mental fabrications that create the tension in the first place. So all that you can do is take refuge in the breath, in the moment, in that this is all a fabrication, and just come back to the present.
Mm-hmm.
And even if your mind state is still agitated, that's the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is just recognize that I have an agitated mind state. And that can lead you to say, wait a minute. And with this state of mind, I shouldn't be doing anything.
Right.
It's really a dangerous place to be. So let me just stop and walk away from the situation. Even when the Buddha talks about the recognizing the problem of craving and clinging, he speaks about it in terms of recognizing the danger in this type of thinking, because it leads to suffering. I mean, and it really, it's a one-to-one correlation. So when you're in that state of mind where you might cause suffering for yourself or others or additional, the only thing to do is stop. You know, don't do anything. Come back to the present moment.
One more thing I wanted to say was that I've also noticed, after reading this chapter, I made this connection to how, and you just hit on it when you were talking about the fourth foundation of mindfulness. When we are agitated and your mindfulness is, you know, just you're not being mindful and you're distracted by an event or a situation, even if I just put the situation down but I don't return to the Eightfold Path, then other situations will become salient. The agitation will just infuse another story.
Yeah.
And it'll just hop from thing to thing to thing that I'll be agitated or frustrated with. So, you know, really coming all the way back to right view and the Four Noble Truths and sort of trying to really stay with that.
Yeah.
It's
the only way. Look at the political climate. Everybody's going in all these different kind of hysterical directions.
Right.
And it's all rooted in that first...
Yeah.
While you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, the things... I've unintentionally, at least almost 100% of the time, hurt people, and I've hurt myself, when I've reacted from a state of frustration or anger or resentment or all the rest of it. Maybe just, you know, just being too frustrated with dealing with the world. But I've never hurt myself or anybody else from a peaceful, calm mind. Mm-hmm. That's just not possible. Again, that's why I keep saying the most loving thing we can do for ourselves and all others is to take to the Dhamma. Because we simply won't be contributing to our own suffering and other people's from that quality of mind. You know, that's the goal. That's where happiness lies, and that's what you were describing. But Becca, you described it too when you said there was a situation came up where you practiced restraint, and that's where it ended, right there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't lead to anything. This is the practical application of this. This is, you know, again, we're not trying to achieve something in the future by being really just wonderful people right now. We're trying to achieve peace and happiness right now by living within the framework of the Eightfold Path with a well-concentrated mind, holding that refined mindfulness of this, and it allows us to live peacefully. You know, that's it. And that's what we're describing. So the hindrances are showing when we're not in a peaceful state of mind.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe our actions aren't peaceful right now. Mm-hmm. We're contributing to awakening, full maturity. You know, it's just practical teaching. So thank you. Tommy, good to see you.
Yeah.
We're in the. I don't know if many of you know Tommy. Tommy joins us every now and then, but he's out in around Reading, Pennsylvania. But when he's back this area, he joins us. It's always good to see you, Tommy.
Thank you so much. Yeah, I'm just coming back, so I'm happy to be here and coming back.
Good. Again, I'm glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
Kevin, good to see you this morning.
So, in a way, it's interesting the five hindrances are some of the easiest things to understand in the teachings, but they're some of the most difficult things to avoid. And I find when I'm meditating, probably the biggest thing is anxiety and worry about things that just come up. They just keep, you know, you try to get back to your breathing, and then things come up. Worried about loved ones, worried about a situation, or where that key, you know, it's sort of, and then you just have to let it go again. It's interesting, too, that different authors interpret the exact names of the hindrances in different ways, too.
Mm.
So the sensual longing really can be attachment, and it's the same, I guess. It's attachment, it's clinging, craving, it's really... So that's the big part of it. Interestingly, too, like ill will, for some reason, something I read was more like avoidance, but I don't know where avoidance is in. That might be more like torpor. Maybe it's a wash of something else.
I can
yeah.
see that.
But I find if I have ill will, sometimes it's toward myself, getting frustrated because my mind keeps going, and then and I'm not gentle with myself, and I project ill will onto myself, thinking, when will I be able to do this? And at times I am breathing and I'm in that moment, and it feels like the most peaceful time, and I just, that becomes a craving. I want that peace.
Yeah.
Mm.
So it gets a little bit circular. But mostly it's this anxiety or just worry, getting wrapped up in what has to be fixed in my life or in the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
So I found that I have a loved one who's had terrible anxiety, depression, and in the past I might have gotten myself into a lather or such worry that I have to fix this, I have to fix this, I have to fix this. And then I get anxious, and in the past that happened. But now, just with mindfulness and with knowing that this is impermanent, I'm able to sit quietly with that person and reassure and say, this will pass, this is going to pass, this is not forever. And your mind is going, and you're thinking that things are going to be horrible, but we can't predict, and you're just here, we're here now, and we're going to get through this moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it has helped me so much, and I think it helps the other person tremendously, too. So, that's that.
Thank you. That yeah, it does help the other person when we we're not reacting to something, and that restlessness and worry about a situation, someone that we care deeply for, and understanding that in the context of the Four Noble Truths, that dukkha occurs in everybody's life. That's a consequence. And what can we do? Most of the time, the most effective thing we can do is to simply be present with someone without a reactive mind, or at least as calm and peaceful as we can. Things are going to happen. I mean, that's just part of being in the world. It doesn't mean that we're detached, right? When when the Buddha heard that his dad was about to pass, he didn't go find a tree to meditate and get away from it. He got his little bag of stuff and he walked 140 miles to be with his dad before he died. And he gave him a final teaching in the Dhamma. You know, I was thinking about my own dad. He's 90, almost be 99 in next month, April. And yeah, I mean, it's incredible that we've had this much. When he hit 80, I started getting this feeling every time I left him that, you know, that's probably the last time. Well, that thought has persisted for almost 20 years now. And he's slowly fading away. Physically, he's, you know, he was never tall. We're not, you know, the Haspels aren't big people. But yeah, he's pushing 4 feet now, I think. And he still has his faculties, but those are slowly going. And, you know, even the little things like talking correctly. And it's interesting to watch it now from a slightly enlightened point of view and just understanding the process rather than noticing that, you know, one day he is going to be gone. That it's just there. And over time, we've developed this incredible relationship. We always were close. We were always like each other's best friends. But now to just be able to be present with the process and not need it to be any different, not be, you know, this is just what's happening. This is what's occurring. And he feels it. You know, I can see when I show up. He just seems to calm down. Most people, as they start losing it a little bit, become very agitated. And I think it's just because of that. It's a direct response to they don't know where they are anymore. But he feels that. I'm able to give that to him, and I'm not elevating myself to anything special. It's just the Dhamma. But I'm able to give that to him because I'm able to stay present with him. That's all. I'm not doing anything magical. And so thank you for bringing that up. It's such an important... another practical application of the Dhamma when we can relate to people in a much more useful and effective way, you know, and in our own minds too. So. And you mentioned ill will. Ill will is the opposite of goodwill, you know, wishing well for everyone, including ourselves. But it's such a... it's included here because it's such a pervasive problem now, but also obviously during the Buddha's time. You know, people kind of thrive on resentment a lot. You know, and it's hurtful. It's hurtful to ourselves and it's hurtful towards others. And if we bring it onto our meditation cushion, we're going to see it. It's going to leave us with an agitated mind. Again, the practical benefits of it. So thank you for bringing that up today. Jay, good to see you this morning.
Thanks. Good to be here. Good to see you, everybody. This was an easily accessible chapter for me as compared to some of the other ones because it was all stuff I'm real familiar with. The first one on the list, the sexual cravings and stuff, not such a problem anymore. That one's easy to take. Not such an obsession, but the distractions, other distractions and laziness and sort of parts of what we used to call the seven deadly sins, gluttony, sloth, all that stuff. Recognize that, but I do okay with the meditation, and you know, I am retired, and I have simplified my life quite a bit, and I think I'm lucky that I have a lot less things gnawing at me than some of the folks in the room here who are really, you know, still involved in, you know, day-to-day work things, and, you know, perhaps kids, and so on right there, so it's a little easier for me to remain chilled out and meditate. Meditating in the morning here is definitely good. The way it times out, I spend, you know, most of the time paying attention to my breath, but then in between that, I start thinking about a bagel and lox from over there. So I go back and forth between bagel and breathing.
You had to bring that up.
Sorry. He makes a very good ground lox. It's very, very tasty.
Ken's a good cook. Thank you. Yeah, it is. It is just like that, you know. The I'm going to leave it at that. Thank you, Jay. Lisa, good to see you this morning. We got to get out of here. I got to get some bacon.
Well, he's honest. Wow. A lot of things. I thought that the chapter was, you know, I read down the list, yes, 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 not always, sometimes, yeah. You know. And of course, things that everybody says, I think, oh, yes, oh, yeah, you know, and then, you know, Kevin was talking about something, and, you know, I'm one of these people that, like, if someone has a problem, I want to fix it, and... You know, I think I'm hoping that this will help me. Like, you don't know where to draw the line. You want to be helpful to someone, but you can't fix them. And besides, I'm very broken. I need to fix myself.
Yeah.
Never mind fixing anybody.
That's such a profound statement. Yeah.
Yeah.
We start here. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay, but it's still good to want to help other people.
Yeah.
I think Buddhism can help in every single little thing in your life, big thing, anything, everything. If I meditate and I read the book and I think about it, and if I learn, you know. It's learning, it's incorporating. So, yeah, you can do things for people because you're able to, and it's drawing where to draw the line, you know, being helpful and also being good to myself and not saying, oh, I'm so great, I'm going to do this and you know.
Yeah, again, it's so profoundly. See, we understand when we start developing an understanding of the nature of dukkha, we understand what we can do and what we can't do. It's practical. Instead of, there's something very hurtful about denying someone else's, using the umbrella word, denying someone else's suffering. And there can often be a lot of eye-making. Look at what I'm doing for you. Well, suffering is inherent in the world. Much better to like Kevin was talking about, to take a reasonable approach and a knowledgeable approach and an understanding approach. This is what's occurring. And so what we can do is what we can do. Whatever we can do practically, we should do. It doesn't mean we should run away from it or ignore people's suffering, but what can we actually do? What's practical here? And that comes from having a well-concentrated mind and understanding the nature of suffering. You know that story about rather than give someone, I can't remember the exact story, Christian story, but rather than giving someone fish, teach them how to fish. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a practical thing we do. You find someone hungry, you don't say, well, you're suffering, that's your problem. You know, maybe you give them a little bit of help, but you do it in a practical way. That's how the Dhamma is. That's how it works. It allows us to see things clearly. Another way of saying that is right view. We understand the nature of suffering.
Some people seem to, you know, I read about people who read books or people, you know, that I know in the community. And some people seem to have, you know, naturally know how to do the right thing.
Hmm.
And I'm always so, it's like, wow, how do they know? How do they know how to do the right thing? Like, some things just come naturally to people,
mm-hmm.
of, you know, knowing what to do and when.
Yep.
And then they end up doing the right thing. It's like, wow, that was great.
Yeah.
You know, people just are doing great things out there. And
I don't know, maybe it comes naturally to some people and other people. It's like a fight to the finish or something, you know.
Yeah, we all have different qualities of mind arising from conditioned experiences in life. And the most loving thing we can do is to develop a well-concentrated mind and understand the nature of suffering so that we can be with people, you know, in a meaningful way. You know. And that's just what you're describing, too. So, thank you. Eva, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Safety net in a way, because if I'm meditating and something pops into my mind, then I have, because I've been reading the book and getting more knowledgeable about this whole wonderful, profound thing that the Buddha created or whatever, I can find answers and I can, it just has encompassed my whole life and it's made changes that in one area that you can't figure, you know, wow, how did that get here, you know, and it's just amazing, and it makes me very happy. That's about it. You know, I mean, you know, yeah, it's scary, the world's scary, there's things going on, and but I just feel that I've found a path that makes sense to me, and I'm very grateful for that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. So am I. We're going to talk about the Ratana Sutta in a minute, but what we're all talking about in a general way is we found a true refuge in all the dukkha of the world. And it's right here, within our hearts and within our minds, and right here in this room too. So thank you, Debbie. Good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. So I'm relating to a lot that people are saying, and one of the things that is coming up for me is a little bit of envy. Because I'm hearing people talk about meditating for 15 minutes and the time going fast, or having occasional thoughts about a bagel. Or for me, it's like I just keep trying to accept that everyone's mind is different, and not just because of conditioned thinking, but I think there's some chemical differences too. And like I feel like my mind is constantly. I mean. Like, if I meditate for a half hour, like now, maybe I've got a full minute or two accumulated from that 30 minutes of focusing on my breath. Because my thoughts are constant, you know. So, but I still feel like, despite that, that it's changing my life. Because I guess it's just bringing me back when you're back. Because one of the things I've noticed more and more is that when I feel agitated, or I don't know if that's the word, when I feel distracted or reactionary, that if I just take a breath, sometimes I just have this peaceful feeling come over me, and I can just be with that silence inside of me and feel that peace and calm. So, you know, despite the fact that the meditation can be really frustrating, I feel like I'm integrating something from it that's helping my life. And the other insight I got today was, well, for me, the craving and clinging is probably the hardest of the hindrances, the first one,
yeah.
You know, and though I believe all of them. The sensual part, the craving and clinging relates to the sensual part, and I find myself in my meditation, you know, like planning my vacation or something. You know, it's like always planning that next thing. And I kind of got some insight on, you know, part of that is like I'm setting up an expectation for these, like I'm having this big family reunion vacation in the Northwest, so that's been preoccupying a lot of my time planning with my siblings and stuff. And so, you know, I keep going back to stuff, you know, food stuff, everything stuff, and like, you know, there's always an expectation, and then I could, you know, I've had vacations where I go out there and then I'm sick the whole time, you know, so it's like recognizing that I can't live, and, you know, it's for me, it's like constantly realizing I set myself up kind of, and, you you know, for the disappointment or the expectations, and it's never going to necessarily be that way, and it is what it is, and it is right now, and so trying to just live more and more in the present. And then I have one third thing to say that I relate to, and hope I'm not taking too much time.
Nope.
Just the being present that Kevin and you are talking about in terms of helping someone. Like when Lisa was saying she wants to fix it, she's a fix it. Well, I'm a fix it person too. And obviously I've learned a lot in my career about it. Listening is a big part of being there and fixing it for others. But getting it at another level with the meditation, getting it in terms of just with my loved ones, how I want to fix it, and seeing their pain and knowing that they're in the pain. And maybe they don't want me to fix it. They just need me to sit with them. I think it's hard. It's not so hard with my clients, but it's hard with my loved ones, you know, to just sit and be present. It just kind of went in at a really different level this morning about, because of something that recently happened with my, you know, with my spouse who is depressed. And it's like, it was just so helpful that she just needs me to sit and be present with her.
Yeah.
That was really helpful.
It really is. You said a lot, and I wanted to comment on that first thing you said, that out of 30 minutes there might be 1 minute.
Yeah.
That's the importance and the significance of the entire 30 minutes, is that you had that 1 minute, because it's that little bit of spaciousness that concentration starts developing in, you know. And you recognize the benefits. That's so important to recognize that, you know, I've been doing this. Maybe you're not the best meditator in the whole world, but you have some pretty profound benefits. And you're right, there's different levels of conditioning, and it might have to do with some chemical stuff in the brain too. But when you read the accounts in the Pali Canon of people that developed awakening that the Buddha was teaching directly, some people did it almost instantly, Kundana and the first teaching. Others, Sariputta, developed awakening pretty quickly. The Buddha's cousin, who was there for every teaching the Buddha ever gave, didn't awaken until a month after the Buddha passed. But he awakened. You know, that's really the point. And then, it just reiterates something I said. When you're meditating, that's the time to meditate. It doesn't do you much good to be on vacation while you're meditating. Meditate, you know? And it's just that way. But our conditioned thinking wants us to be anything except to sit quietly. So let me get on to all the difficulties with my vacations and what might happen. Now is the time to meditate. You know? So, thank you. I'm glad you're here. Mary, good to see you this morning. How are you?
Good. It resonated with me when you said that you sit down to meditate and you remember you're supposed to do whatever. It's something completely mundane.
Yes.
And it bugs me and bugs me, and I have to just convince myself to sit here. There when we're done, and just concentrate. This is time to concentrate on the breathing. And coming to these classes just really drives the point home of how conditioned my thinking is, but how normal it is to always slip back into those same routines. And that as long as I'm continuing with the meditation, I am improving things. And I know I am, because I know I'm way more patient with people than I used to be. I mean, I used to just toss them off to the side if they're being too ridiculous. And I am just, you know, more patient and not insinuating what I have to say about it. It's just, you know, it's not important. It's just a conversation.
Yeah.
But I think the most important thing I can do for myself is to stick with the meditation and remember the steps that the Buddha taught in general.
That's it. And you've developed great restraint. You know, that's a big part of the Dhamma. You know, we all talked about it, I think. Know when to stop. We don't have to keep insinuating ourselves into everything. We can truly be present with other people, and it changes everything. It changes our entire life when we keep trying to promote this self-referential ego self and just be with what's going on. Thank you, Mary. Lorna, good to see you this morning.
Hi, good to be here. Like everybody else, I bump up against all the fighting things at some time or other. I think everybody does.
Yeah.
and just reflecting back on the, well, the hindrances to following the practice to me are following the practice. Meaning, you look at yourself in a more mindful way and you realize, you know, for instance, and I'll say not self-characteristic in the conditioned thinking that we have. And when you're thinking about that, you can think this is just too damn hard, you know. And so I think just following the practice, you do bump up against hindrances following the practice. And I think the five hindrances really are there to point out to ourselves really what we should be focusing on in our lives.
Yep.
So that, you know, they're very valuable to keep in mind, because they're what our homework is for ourselves. And I think what a few people have said, that when you're actually in the minute, in the moment, and you have, you know, thoughts about that come up about your hindrances, whether it's ill will or sensual desires or, you know, whatever you want to, whatever it is, it is hard to then focus back and think about the Eightfold Path, and think about right view and right intention and right effort, and it's kind of hard to sort of calm your mind down to think about those things.
Yeah.
However, in this chapter, you said about the river.
Mm-hmm.
If it divides, the water gets divided, 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 you lose the flow of the river. And I think that's a very easy thought process to sort of jumping on when you are in a situation of being distracted and confused, which we all are because we're not awakened. But you can sort of, it's like a flash in your mind. You can just sort of see that. Although you maybe can't recognize and think about the actual words of, say, right view, right intention and things, you can just jump on that image and think, right, I'm getting distracted here. You know, get back into the full flow. This is the distraction. Just get back into the full flow.
Yeah.
And that's an easier way to keep you on track. The Dharma practice, put it that way.
Oh yeah,
I think that was a good image.
Mm-hmm. That is. Thank you for sharing it. That hindrances are just that. The Buddha recognized this 2,600 years ago from teaching. You know, he recognized that these were common things that came up to everybody that he was teaching, and so hindrances, it's a block. Recognize it, that's all. Recognize that this is something that can stand in the way of me developing the Dhamma. Don't let it. You know, don't let it get in the way. Keep going. Keep coming back to the true refuge, which leads to the talk today. So, any other questions about the hindrances? Oh, sure.
I think you were talking to somebody before me, and he said everything, he said sensual desire, but everything sort of follows out after that.
Yep.
The ill will. Sensual desire, is that right? That's the first thing that takes you away from the Dharma practice, and then the others are feeding from the sensual desire.
Yes, you can really say that, and and it also has to be seen in the proper context of developing understanding of the nature of suffering and our contributions through craving and clinging. So craving and clinging arise from that initial sensory input from something, or the constant need for sensory input. You know, so dependent origination, that's part of, I think it's the sixth step. I don't know if you remember that. That it is contact with our sixth sense base, our five physical senses, and consciousness. Remember, consciousness rooted in ignorance. It's not this grand cosmic consciousness. Contact through that leads to craving and clinging. And that is the... a mind that is no longer ignorant and fully awake and fully mature mind knows how to handle sensory input. Without the proper context, we don't have it yet, and we use sensory input to continue the self-referential views rather than recognizing the inherent impermanence and dukkha that follows from that, from craving and attaching ourselves to objects, events, views, and ideas. When we're again, what we're talking about today, when we're simply mindful of what's occurring, none of that happens. We don't create more clinging or more attachment. And we're able to be much more present, which means that we can enjoy, I always go back to chocolate cake, we can enjoy that one piece of chocolate cake without needing the whole cake. We can enjoy our lives just as they are without needing more. It's another thing that the self-referential ego self, that which the Buddha said is anatta, can never be satisfied. And there's so many different, so many stories of people that had acquired a lot of something and it was never enough. There's so many stories of people that, when I was talking about this the other night, that's probably why it's coming up now. There's so many stories of people that have won the lottery, and 2 years later they're broke, and some of them are dead from that whole experience of just having everything they ever wanted, and they can't handle it. You know, we're not built that way, but we are built to handle what's occurring right now, if we have the proper mind for it. If what's occurring right now is not rooted in ignorance. And getting back to what Kevin said, and we really, it's kind of an underlying theme, is just being present with people. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination. It says, from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. Well, what is it when we're not able to be present with someone? We're ignoring them, aren't we? If we're stuck in our head about how this situation should be different, or this person should be different, or where I'm going on vacation while someone is talking to me, we're ignoring them. That's what the Buddha meant. And that creates all kinds of suffering in our lives. The opposite is true. When we've let go of all craving and clinging, we've now developed the ability to be present in our life as life occurs and with other people. Debbie, you had your hand up.
I was just so relating to that, because I was thinking about the self-referential piece and how our ego is, when we're not present with people, or for myself, when we're trying to fix it, that's really about us.
Yes.
It's about our attachment to them and wanting to help them, and it isn't really about them. And coming from that place that's not about us,
yeah,
just being present.
That again, that's such a profound statement. That's it. It's when we can remove ourselves from it, when there's no self-referential view, then we're truly present. You know, Jen.
Yeah, I was just going to drive that point home because when I'm having difficulty. There's something that Matt said to me one time. I'm having difficulty being present. When you're agitated in a situation, you're not able to be present. You're not in a place where you can be present with it. It's helpful to notice where I'm attaching myself to them, to their suffering, or to the dukkha of that situation. How it's helpful to notice how I'm saying, I need this to be different.
Yeah.
I need them to not be upset anymore. I need to fix this. I need to manage this so that I can feel better, or so that I can. So it's just helpful to notice that, and because that helps kind of. So emptying the world of yourself, you know, it can be like very, like, what? But just in that like moment of just saying, you know, this person is uncomfortable, they're suffering. How am I attaching myself to that? How am I just noticing it? Will allow me to be present, even if it means being present with my own clinging.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Acknowledging
it
that.
Removes, yeah. It removes it, me needing to fix them so that I can feel better. It just takes that piece off of it.
Yeah. And it changes the whole dynamic of that situation, too. One of the things that I find kind of disturbing when I hear people saying it is somebody's just said something, they poured their heart out to you, and then you respond by, I'm not saying you, but their response is, this is what I hear you saying. Well, that's often, you're putting that what those person's words in your context, not actually listening to what they're saying. Simply be present with what's occurring. When you read the stories of the Buddha, whether he's addressing, and I'm going to read one in just a minute or two, whether it's a large group or it's just one-on-one, you can feel how he's just so... The Buddha was often given superhuman powers like clairvoyance and mind reading and all this stuff. He said that wasn't what he was about. He was just able to be so mindfully present that it seemed like he was reading someone's mind. But he knew what was occurring because he was present. That's something that we can all do. We all have those sensibilities about us if we're not distracted by our own thoughts. We understand what's going on. You know, it's not like we're reading someone's mind, but we can understand what's going on. They say one of the worst things you can do to a child is to ignore the child. One of the worst things. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of terrible things we can do. But that is one of the... An ongoing ignorance of a child or an adult can be devastating. And, you know, if you've ever been upset with someone, usually, especially before we've encountered a Dhamma, usually the first thing you'll want to do is ignore them. You know, that's how we show people that we're upset with them. You know, we might not answer the phone call or hear what they have to already. You know, that's what we do. Where does that come from? That need for ignorance? It's part of dependent origination, and it can only lead to suffering. Be present with people. Okay, any other questions about that? So you'll see, especially with Jen... Oh, I'm sorry, Kevin. I didn't see you.
It's not a question. It's just an observation.
Please.
Like when I... And I haven't been doing this very long, but when I read about it, I read that doubt would be the most difficult thing to overcome in the hindrances. Mm. But in this Sangha, I don't think there's much doubt. I think we don't doubt. I can feel that there's... That's something that's already... been overcome.
Boy, thank you for saying that, and you're right, it is powerful. I mean, it really comes down to, I won't allow doubt in this room. No doubt. There's actually some, you got me thinking, there's actually some traditions that talk about cultivating that doubt, that great doubt, and maybe that's true. When you experience, it comes back to how the Buddha taught too, ehepasiko, come and see for yourself. When you experience it, and it doesn't take a long time to see the benefits of it, there is no more doubt. You know that this is the right thing to do. You know it's going to lead to the extinguishing, which is what nirvana means, or nibbana. It's going to put out the fires of craving and clinging. Because we've experienced it, even if it is just for one moment in a 30-minute meditation, that's enough to recognize the effectiveness of this teaching. So this sangha, the Ratana Sutta directly relates to what we were talking about here today in general, and what Jen just mentioned. I'll read it. It's gotten a little bit late, but this isn't a long sutta. Nearly all schools of Buddhism refer to the three jewels and taking refuge in them. The three jewels are also called the three refuges. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a protection or a shelter from hardship or danger. Refuge is a place or state of mind that is a source of comfort and peace. Years ago, 20 years ago now, I used to go to Hawaii often, and they're still there. They had these places called the City of Refuges or Place of Refuges. They're all over the Hawaiian Islands. And way back, you know, this is probably going into the 1200s or the 1400s, all the little islands had different kingdoms on them, and they were always fighting with each other, and they were pretty violent skirmishes that they had. But they set up these places called refuges, city of refuges, where if you were so overwhelmed by the violence that you were engaged in, and you could make it to these cities of refuges, these little spots on these islands, you were safe. And you could stay there until the conflict was over, and you walked back out into the society. There's a few of those that I visited, and they're just remarkable places when you think about it. One was called, I can't think of it now. It was so long ago. But it was this. It was an area near Captain Cook, which is on the southern part of the Big Island, and it was part of a cove. But this little cove was always infested with sharks. And you had to swim through, this was part of the deal, you had to swim through those waters. Once you got through the shark-infested waters and were on land, you were safe and no one could touch you until the conflict was over. This is a kind of refuge it's metaphorical of what the Buddha is talking about. You can get through the shark-infested waters of dukkha and make it to the shore of the Dhamma, and you found a true refuge. And if you stay in that refuge, the dukkha is not going to touch you. That doesn't mean that you're not going to be affected. You won't react to the sharks anymore. And just think about that a little bit while I'm reading the rest of this. So the three jewels are the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. In Buddhism, when one takes refuge, one is taking refuge in these three precious jewels. The ritual of taking refuge is a formal and usually public statement of holding the strong intention to have the example of the Buddha and the teachings of the Dhamma be the framework for awakening, along with supporting and receiving the support of a community of Dhamma practitioners, our Sangha. The teaching known as the Jewel Discourse, or the Ratana Sutta, was given in the city of Visali at a time of widespread famine and spreading disease. There were many dead bodies as the conditions overwhelmed the ability to properly dispose of bodies. The local citizens sought out the Buddha's help, who was nearby in Rajagaha. The Buddha arrived in Visali a short time later with a large number of monks, including Ananda. Just before the Buddha's arrival, torrential rains helped the situation somewhat by cleansing the landscape of rotting corpses and clearing the air and the water. So it's a pretty tough picture right there. But again, it relates to what Jen was just talking about. These difficulties are going to come up in life. What do we do? Well, the first thing we find that the Buddha did is he attended to the practical nature or the practical matter at hand, which was taking physical care of the people. Prior to his presenting this discourse, he instructed his attending monks to walk through the city and do what they could to ease the physical suffering of the citizens and to individually present his teaching. At the formal teaching, the Buddha then presented a way to bring true refuge from the stress and suffering of the world and to put an end to all dukkha. The Buddha's words. Now he's talking to this town, devastated by what has occurred. May all beings assembled have peace of mind. May all beings assembled listen mindfully to these words. Think about this. Now, these people are desperate. The Buddha's referring to now develop your peace of mind. And then he says, may you all radiate goodwill and loving kindness to all who offer help. He's immediately taking their thought pattern from, I'm suffering, what's the matter with me, this is awful, and turning it outwards. Start expressing goodwill towards others. Then he says, understand this. There is no more precious jewel, no more refuge, no more comfort than the Buddha. Now, the Buddha is not setting himself up as somebody to be worshipped. He's holding himself up as an example of what to do when times get tough. And he's saying, if I can do it, you can do it. There is no more precious jewel, no more refuge, no more comfort than the Buddha. As woodland groves in the early heat of summer are crowned with blossoming flowers, so is the sublime Dhamma leading to the common peace of Nirvana. Isn't that beautiful words? The peerless and excellent awakened one, the teacher of true understanding, the teacher of the noble path is the Buddha, the one who has awakened, which is the only way he describes himself, as the guy, the first one that awakened. Here the Buddha is not, these are my words, here the Buddha is not teaching worship of himself. The Buddha often referred to himself as the Tathagata, meaning the one who has gone forth. The Buddha had gone forth from distraction and ignorance, stress and suffering, to well-concentrated wisdom. He liberated himself from clinging to all objects and views. Through his own efforts, Siddhartha Gautama awakened to become a Buddha. The Buddha is here offering himself as the example of one going forth on the Eightfold Path and Awakening. Taking refuge in the Buddha is understanding that all human beings can go forth from ignorance and attain wisdom and right understanding. There is great protection and comfort in understanding that liberation and freedom is possible for all human beings. And this relates to how some of the later developed schools, in fact, the reason why there was a split about 400 years after the Buddha's passing was that there was a sect called the Mahasanghikas that wanted a more visionary type of Dhamma practice, and they wanted to elevate the Buddha to a position of a god and one of many Buddha-like gods that we should worship. And if you think about why we develop, what we'd want to develop something like that, is now, excuse me, if the Buddha is a god, a superhuman being, then I don't really have to do much except worship the god, and then I'll be bestowed with awakening, rather than actually have to address my self-referential views. And there's a very subtle but very significant aspect of I-making in that. When you do something like that, I don't want to get into that whole reason behind it, but it's related into the developed bodhisattva path, which says that I'll delay my own awakening until all sentient beings are awakening. Well, of course, that's not possible, is it? You know, it doesn't relate to the first noble truth or anything else the Buddha ever taught. But that's where it comes from. Was there a question?
No, I just said interesting.
Yeah, it is. The Buddha continues, there is no more precious jewel than the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The Buddha, calm and mindful, has experienced the cessation of clinging and desire. The deathless state of nirvana has been attained. Now that's another important line. So you could just hear that line, take it out of context and say, well, the Buddha's talking about somehow living forever, isn't he? But of course, that's not what he's talking about, even the example of his life. He died at 80. He left the physical form at the age of 80. It has to do with karma and rebirth that we studied in week 9, I think it was. What he's talking about is that in the deathless state is that I have now achieved awakening, and I can no longer give birth to another moment that is rooted in ignorance. Suffering has died. That's the deathless state. That's what the Buddha's talking about. Creating that situation in our lives where we are now incapable of giving any karma, any arising, any momentum, any thought to another moment that's prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. We cannot give birth to that anymore. That's the true understanding of karma and rebirth that the Buddha is referring to in that one sentence. The Buddha teaches the Noble Eightfold Path that unfailingly brings concentration, liberation, and freedom. There is no more precious jewel than the Dhamma. The Buddha, in my words, the Buddha is describing that there is a precious jewel in taking refuge in the path of liberation and freedom. In this setting, in Visali, the Buddha is teaching that once practical needs have been taken care of, to turn one's attention to being mindful of the teachings of the Buddha. And by inference, he's also teaching the people of Visali that what just occurred in their life, the great devastation, is part of the first noble truth. But remember how he started this talk, but you can maintain a calm and peaceful mind despite what's going on around you by taking refuge in the Buddha and the Dhamma. Now he's going to teach a little bit about the Sangha. The Buddha continues, there is no more precious jewel than the Sangha. Understanding this brings true liberation and freedom. The virtuous ones who bring the Dhamma, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those with steadfast minds, free of clinging, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Those that understand with wisdom the Four Noble Truths, they are the jewel of the Sangha. And we've all just experienced that right here, haven't you? Haven't we? We've shared our understanding of the Dhamma. You know, not to be too dramatic, we are all the jewels of the Sangha. That's what the Buddha is referring to. And of course, to have that, to have a sangha that is a true refuge, it has to be what Kevin said. It has to be well focused. It has to be a sangha that doesn't really have any doubt. And that doesn't mean that there won't be a time here and there where we'll have this thought, well, maybe this is a waste of time. But our practice is basically free of doubt. And we are, I say this so often because I've had a lot of experience in different groups. we are so fortunate to have the Sangha that we've developed here. And it's, and again, that's not just me. We have all come together in the Dhamma and have formed a true Sangha, as a true jewel of the Sangha too. The Buddha continues, those that gain true insight and abandon self-delusion, doubt, and indulgence in meaningless rites and rituals, they are the jewel of the Sangha. Again, the Buddha is talking about, even during his time, there was a lot of different teachers that practiced using rather elaborate rites and rituals, including human and animal sacrifice, as a path to whatever they felt was awakening. And the Buddha is just speaking directly to that. It's not rites and rituals. You know, it's got nothing to do with any of that. It has to do with developing the Dhamma and really changing the way we think about ourselves in relation to the three marks of existence. Those whose understanding arises from the support of the Sangha, who can no longer conceal the truth from themselves due to the Sangha, they are the precious jewel of the Sangha. So we don't let anybody get away with anything in here, do we? Those whose karma is extinguished, is the word for nirvana or nibbana, those whose karma is extinguished, the future of no concern, what were we talking about, worry, the future of no concern, with rebirth ending, due to the support of the Sangha, this is the precious jewel of the Sangha. We can't do it alone. That's the end of the Buddha's words, my words. The example of the Buddha's life, the teachings of the Buddha, the Dhamma, along with the support of the Sangha, provides refuge from the suffering of distraction and ignorance arising from dukkha. Being mindful of the three jewels concentrates the mind to what is of utmost importance. Taking refuge in the three jewels is taking great comfort in understanding that awakening is possible for any human being. The example of the Buddha's life shows just that. There is great comfort in realizing that the way of liberation is a path accessible and integrated by anyone, the Eightfold Path. There is also great comfort in knowing that we do not engage in the path of liberation and freedom alone. The Buddha often said that the most important aspect of practice is the Sangha. The support and commitment that we gain from each other often provides the encouragement and strength to continue, even when difficult times interfere. Holding in mind the three jewels provides continual direction for one's mindfulness. Taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha also provides a framework for mindful expression of joy and freedom. We've got a place to talk about how fun this is. That's the end of that. And just to make one more point, I gave a talk this past Wednesday on the Kalama Sutta, my Wednesday Dhamma talk online. And I'm just bringing it up now, as you might want to listen to it because it relates directly to this. The Kalama Sutta was given to a group called the Kalamas, who were very confused about all the different teachers that came through where they lived. They lived on a trade route in northern India, so all the teachers at the time came through there. Well, everyone said, this is the one true Dhamma, you need to follow me, leaving this poor town very confused. And they asked the Buddha, how do we know? How do we know who we should follow? And without getting into the whole sutta, the Buddha basically said, you have to develop the Dhamma as I teach it and then relate it to the rest of these teachings and see what is most effective for you. And what he was saying was, there's this kind of conditioned response that most of modern Buddhism has, is that the Buddha taught us to question everything. And he said that over. The Buddha never said that, he never taught something for 45 years and said, by the way, you should question this. What he was saying, and what has been taken out of context, he says, if you're confused by the Dhamma, to question me directly. Of course, we can't do that anymore, but what we can do is to question or look to the account, the Pali Canon, the written record of the Buddha's teachings. We can look to that today. Or we can question someone who has actually studied that. The reason why that's important, and you can see how the idea of the refuges have been has been lost when we're practicing a false Dhamma, to use the word. And in the talk I got into a little bit of a rant, but there's many modern practices called Buddhist practices that have worldwide followings, and the teachers have gotten so far off the Dhamma that they've justified things like teaching while they're drunk or on drugs, actually justifying infidelity in their marriages, and giving, and even to having sexual relations with their with people under them. And there's a very well-known and well-established practice. I won't give the name of it, but anybody that had the unfortunate, I shouldn't use that word, anyone that's been involved in it would probably know what I'm talking about. This teacher's still alive. He developed such a twisted dharma from not following the simple Buddhist teachings that he actually taught that it's okay to have sex with young boys, even children. And he used, again, here's the rant again, he used the idea of conditioned thinking is this will help decondition their minds. Can you imagine that? And this gentleman is still alive. He's in his 90s now. He finally gave an apology, but he admitted nothing. He said, if I did anything wrong, well, I didn't really mean it. Ah. What's disturbing, and I've seen this in so many different ones, not just this one that I'm talking about, is that the followers now excuse that. They excuse that teaching as, in some way, they just don't want to see it. But that's another act of ignorance, isn't it? We're going to ignore what's obvious. There's another famous teacher that his students reveled in the idea that he could give Dhamma teachings drunk and still be somehow useful. Would you listen to me if I was sitting up here smashed? I'll help you. What? I mean, really, but think how we, again, here, excuse the rant. But when we ignore the Buddhist teachings, this is what can follow from it. And that's, and again, I'm not putting down the suffering that these other people went through, even though they developed pretty big organizations. I really feel for them because they allowed the affirmation that they were getting to think that they were right. And everybody in those organizations are responsible for that, not just the teacher, but, you know, again, just to make the point, when you ignore the Buddhist teachings, anything is possible. But when we develop that framework of the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, the right livelihood guide our actions and everything. Lisa.
John, do you see any similarities to what you just described to what was going on in the Catholic Church? And it's not just Catholic, you know, not just that religion, but those things happen in other religions where people in power become, you know, arrogant you know, do things that are so contrary, you know, to what their position should represent.
And there's I was going to say I don't want to condemn. So I'm not condemning Catholicism or all the other religions, but I am condemning obviously those actions and the arrogance that it's rooted in. Bringing this back to what we're talking about today, the Ratana Sutta, if we are taking true refuge, and one of those I was talking about, I can't go there because I don't want to identify it too closely. Taking true refuge in the Dhamma means that we've actually developed the Dhamma. And if we've actually done that, nothing like that could follow.
Right.
You couldn't possibly, if you've actually developed the Dhamma for yourself, you couldn't possibly want to give teachings while you're drunk and talk about how wonderful it is that you can do it or have your students believe that. You wouldn't justify cheating on your wife. You wouldn't justify having sex with young boys or children. How could you? But the proof is in the pudding. If you've done that, anybody that follows that should recognize that. And that is a real danger. So we have people supporting that type of teaching. I don't want to go too far with this, but you should recognize it. You know, if you're relating it back to the Ratana Sutta, can you imagine the Buddha acting that way and then expecting people to follow him and listen to him? Ehepisika. Why would they? Why would anybody with any sense do that? But of course he did it. He lived the Dhamma. And if you want to know a true Dhamma, look at what it brings. Does it bring release from clinging? Does it develop peace and happiness? Or does it create justification for the common human failings? Again, going back to the first and second noble truth. Does it develop a cessation from craving and clinging? The proof is in the pudding. And we've all talked about that here, how we've developed that for ourselves. Even if it's just for a moment in meditation, even if it's just in isolated situations in our lives, but we see it, we recognize it. We recognize the true comfort and safety of taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So excuse me for the rant. I am clinging to the time when there'll be all perfect Buddhist teachers, but it's not likely to happen.
Discursive thinking is frustrating.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And you know, that's also an example of even within the Dhamma, dukkha occurs. Mm-hmm. And we should have some wisdom to look at that and not just ignore it. You know, that's an important thing. That's the teaching today. Any questions or comments? And I hope I didn't make anybody uncomfortable with my rant. I just think it...
We're all human.
Okay, so let's finish with the Ratana Sutta. With the Karaniya Metta Sutta. So find your relaxed meditative posture. Gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become aware of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future, or that may have arisen from our talk today. And metta means goodwill or loving kindness, and it's both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awake and fully mature human being. And let's maybe keep in mind those poor souls that have developed the Dhamma in a way that ends up being hurtful towards others. So they're rooted in ignorance, just like we all once were. The Buddha's words on metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.